Chapter 6. Frequent. Once we passed a long line of F-25s going single file up a hillside. Farther on we watched a big detachment of artillery galloping across a stretch of open country. The movement of supplies was continuous, and every village through which we passed swarmed with soldiers busy loading or unloading the big vans, or clustered about the commissariat motors, while hams and quarters of beef were handed out. As we approached Verdun the cannonade had grown louder again, and when we reached the walls of the town, and passed under the iron teeth of the portcullis we felt ourselves in one of the last outposts of a mighty line of defense. The desolation of Verdun is as impressive as the feverish activity of Chalons. The civil population was evacuated in September, and only a small percentage have returned. 9/10 of the shops are closed, and as the troops are nearly all in the trenches there is hardly any movement in the streets. The first duty of the traveler who has successfully passed the challenge of the sentinel at the gates is to climb the steep hill to the citadel at the top of the town. Here the military authorities inspect one's papers and deliver a armistice which must be verified by the police before lodgings can be obtained. We found the principal hotel much less crowded than the Haute-Mere-Dieu at Chalons, though many of the officers of the garrison mess there. The whole atmosphere of the place was different. Silent, concentrated, passive. To the chance observer, Verdun appears to live only in its hospitals, and of these there are 14 within the walls alone. As darkness fell, the streets became completely deserted, and the cannonade seemed to grow nearer and more incessant. That first night the hush was so intense that every reverberation from the dark hills beyond the walls brought out in the mind its separate vision of destruction. And then, just as the strained imagination could bear no more, the thunder ceased. A moment later, in a court below my windows, a pigeon began to coo, and all night long the two sounds strangely alternated. On entering the gates, the first sight to attract us had been a colony of roughly built bungalows scattered over the miry slopes of a little park adjoining the railway station, and surmounted by the sign : Evacuation Hospital No. 6. The next morning we went to visit it. A part of the station buildings has been adapted to hospital use, and among them a great roofless hall, which the surgeon in charge has covered in with canvas, and divided down its length into a double row of tents. Each tent contains two wooden cots, scrupulously clean and raised high above the floor, and the immense ward is warmed by a row of stoves down the central passage. In the bungalows across the road are beds for the patients who are to be kept for a time before being transferred to the hospitals in the town. In one bungalow an operating room has been installed, in another are the bathing arrangements for the newcomers from the trenches. Every possible device for the relief of the wounded has been carefully thought out and intelligently applied by the surgeon in charge and the infirmier major who indefatigably seconds him. Evacuation Hospital No. 6 sprang up in an hour, almost, on the dreadful August day, when 4,000 wounded lay on stretchers between the railway station and the gate of the little park across the way. And it has gradually grown into the model of what such a hospital may become in skillful and devoted hands. Verdun has other excellent hospitals for the care of the severely wounded who cannot be sent farther from the front. Among them St. Nicholas, in a big airy building on the Meuse, is an example of a great French military hospital at its best. But I visited few others, for the main object of my journey was to get to some of the second-line ambulances beyond the town. The first we went to was in a small village to the north of Verdun, not far from the enemy's lines at Cassenvoye, and was fairly representative of all the others. The dreary muddy village was crammed with troops, and the ambulance had been installed at haphazard in such houses as the military authorities could spare. The arrangements were primitive but clean, and even the dentist had set up his apparatus in one of the rooms. The men lay on mattresses or in wooden cots, and the rooms were heated by stoves. The great need, here as everywhere, was for blankets and clean underclothing. for the wounded are brought in from the front encrusted with frozen mud, and usually without having washed or changed for weeks. There are no women nurses in the second-line ambulances, but all the army doctors we saw seemed intelligent, and anxious to do the best they could for their men in conditions of unusual hardship. The principal obstacle in their way is the overcrowded state of the villages. Thousands of soldiers are camped in all of them, in hygienic conditions that would be bad enough for men in health. And there is also a great need for light diet, since the hospital commissariat of the front apparently supplies no invalid foods, and men burning with fever have to be fed on meat and vegetables. In the afternoon we started out again in a snowstorm, over a desolate rolling country to the south of Verdun. The wind blew fiercely across the whitened slopes, and no one was in sight, but the sentries marching up and down the railway lines, and an occasional cavalryman patrolling the lonely road. Nothing can exceed the mournfulness of this depopulated land. We might have been wandering over the wilds of Poland. We ran some 20 miles down the steel gray Meuse to a village about 4 miles west of Les Eperges, the spot where, for weeks past, a desperate struggle had been going on. There must have been a lull in the fighting that day, for the cannon had ceased, but the scene at the point where we left the motor gave us the sense of being on the very edge of the conflict. The long straggling village lay on the river, and the trampling of cavalry and the hauling of guns had turned the land about it into a mud flat. Before the primitive cottage, where the doctor's office had been installed, were the motors of the surgeon, and the medical inspector who had accompanied us. Nearby stood the usual flock of gray motor vans, and all about was the coming and going of cavalry remounts, the riding up of officers, the unloading of supplies, the incessant activity of mud-splashed sergeants and men. The main ambulance was in a grange, of which the two stories had been partitioned off in two wards. Under the cobwebby rafters the men lay in rows on clean pallets, and big stoves made the rooms dry and warm. But the great superiority of this ambulance was its nearness to a canal boat which had been fitted up with hot douches. The boat was spotlessly clean, and each cabin was shut off by a gay curtain of red flowered chintz. Those curtains must do almost as much as the hot water to make over the morale of the men. They were the most comforting sight of the day. Farther north, and on the other bank of the Meuse, lies another large village which has been turned into a colony of eclopes. 1,500 sick or exhausted men are housed there, and there are no hot douches or chintz curtains to cheer them. We were taken first to the church, a large featureless building at the head of the street. In the doorway our passage was obstructed by a mountain of damp straw which a gang of hostler soldiers were pitchforking out of the aisles. The interior of the church was dim and suffocating. Between the pillars hung screens of plaited straw, forming little enclosures in each of which about a dozen sick men lay on more straw, without mattresses or blankets. No beds, no tables, no chairs, no washing appliances in their muddy clothes. As they come from the front, they are bedded down on the stone floor like cattle till they are well enough to go back to their job. It was a pitiful contrast to the little church at Lurkert, with the altar lights twinkling above the clean beds, and one wondered if even so near the front, it had to be. "The African village, we call it," one of our companions said with a laugh. "But the African village has blue sky over it, and a clear stream runs between its mud huts." We had been told at St. Menehould that, for military reasons, we must follow a more southerly direction on our return to Chalons, and when we left Verdun we took the road to Bar-le-Duc. It runs southwest over beautiful broken country, untouched by war except for the fact that its villages, like all the others in this region, are either deserted or occupied by troops. As we left Verdun behind us the sound of the cannon grew fainter and died out, and we had the feeling that we were gradually passing beyond the flaming boundaries into a more normal world. But suddenly, at a crossroad, a signpost snatched us back to war. St. Mihiel, 18 kilometers. St. Mihiel, the danger spot of the region, the weak joint in the armor. There it lay, up that harmless-looking by road. Not much more than 10 miles away, a 10-minute dash would have brought us into the thick of the great coats and spiked helmets. The shadow of that signpost followed us for miles, darkening the landscape like the shadow from a racing storm cloud. Bar-le-Duc seemed unaware of the cloud. The charming old town was in its normal state of provincial apathy. Few soldiers were about, and here at last civilian life again predominated. After a few days on the edge of the war, in that intermediate region under its solemn spell, there is something strangely lowering to the mood in the first sight of a busy unconscious community. One looks instinctively, in the eyes of the passers-by, for a reflection of that other vision, and feels diminished by contact with people going so indifferently about their business. A little way beyond Bar-le-Duc we came on another phase of the war vision, for our route lay exactly in the track of the August invasion, and between Bar-le-Duc and Vitry-le-François the high road is lined with ruined towns. The first we came to was Limond, a large village wiped out, as if a cyclone had beheaded it. Then comes Rivigny, a town of over 2,000 inhabitants, less completely leveled, because its houses were more solidly built, but a spectacle of more tragic desolation, with its wide streets winding between scorched and contorted fragments of masonry, bits of shop fronts, handsome doorways, the colonnaded court of a public building. A few miles farther lies the most piteous of the group, the village of Hiltz-le-Morpht, once pleasantly set in gardens and orchards, now an ugly waste like the others, and with a little church so stripped and wounded and dishonored, that it lies there by the roadside like a human victim. In this part of the country, which is one of many crossroads, we began to have unexpected difficulty in finding our way, for the names and distances on the milestones have all been effaced, the signposts thrown down and the enameled plaques on the houses at the entrance to the villages removed. One report has it that this precaution was taken by the inhabitants at the approach of the invading army, another that the Germans themselves demolished the signposts and plastered over the milestones in order to paint on them misleading and encouraging distances. The result is extremely bewildering, for, all the villages being either in ruins or uninhabited, there is no one to question, but the soldiers one meets, and their answer is almost invariably, "We don't know, we don't belong here." One is in luck, if one comes across a sentinel who knows the name of the village he is guarding. It was the strangest of sensations, to find ourselves in a chartless wilderness within 60 or 70 miles of Paris, and to wander, as we did, for hours across a high heathery waste, with wide blue distances to north and south, and in all the scene not a landmark by means of which we could make a guess at our whereabouts. One of our haphazard turns at last brought us into a muddy by-road with long lines of E-25s ranged along its banks like grey anteaters in some monstrous menagerie. A little farther on we came to a bemired village swarming with artillery and cavalry, and found ourselves in the thick of an encampment just on the move. It seems improbable that we were meant to be there, for our arrival caused such surprise that no sentry remembered to challenge us, and obsequiously saluting South officers instantly cleared a way for the motor. So, by a happy accident, we caught one more war picture, all of vehement movement, as we passed out of the zone of war. We were still very distinctly in it on returning to Chalons, which, if it had seemed packed on our previous visit, was now quivering and cracking with fresh crowds. The stir about the fountain, in the square before the Haute Mere Dieu, was more melodramatic than ever. Everyone was in a hurry, everyone booted and mud-splashed, and spurred or sorted or dispatch-bagged, or somehow labeled as a member of the huge military beehive. The privilege of telephoning and telegraphing being denied to civilians in the war zone, It was ominous to arrive at nightfall on such a crowded scene, and we were not surprised to be told that there was not a room left at the Haute Mirdieu, and that even the sofas in the reading room had been let for the night. At every other inn in the town we met with the same answer, and finally we decided to ask permission to go on as far as Epernay, about 12 miles off. At headquarters we were told that our request could not be granted. No motors are allowed to circulate after nightfall in the zone of war, and the officer charged with the distribution of motor permits pointed out that, even if an exception were made in our favor, we should probably be turned back by the first sentinel we met, only to find ourselves unable to re-enter Chalons without another permit. This alternative was so alarming that we began to think ourselves relatively lucky to be on the right side of the gates, and we went back to the Haute Mirdieu to squeeze into a crowded corner of the restaurant for dinner. The hope that someone might have suddenly left the hotel in the interval was not realized, but after dinner we learned from the landlady that she had certain rooms permanently reserved for the use of the staff, and that, as these rooms had not yet been called for that evening, we might possibly be allowed to occupy them for the night. At Chalons the headquarters are in the prefecture, a coldly handsome building of the 18th century, and there, in a majestic stone vestibule, beneath the gilded ramp of a great festal staircase, we waited in anxious suspense, among the orderlies and estafettes, while our unusual request was considered. The result of the deliberation was an expression of regret. Nothing could be done for us, as officers might at any moment arrive from the general headquarters and require the rooms. It was then past 9 o'clock, and bitterly cold, and we began to wonder. Finally, the polite officer who had been charged to dismiss us, moved to compassion at our plight, offered to give us a laissez passer back to Paris. But Paris was about 125 miles off, the night was dark, the cold was piercing, and at every crossroad and railway crossing a sentinel would have to be convinced of our right to go farther. We remembered the warning given us earlier in the evening, and, declining the offer, went out again into the cold. And just then chance took pity on us. In the restaurant we had run across a friend attached to the staff, and now, meeting him again in the depth of our difficulty, we were told of lodgings to be found nearby. He could not take us there, for it was past the hour when he had a right to be out, or we either, for that matter, since curfew sounds at 9 at Chalons. But he told us how to find our way through the maze of little unlit streets about the cathedral. Standing there beside the motor, in the icy darkness of the deserted square, and whispering hastily, as he turned to leave us, "Colin, you ought not to be out so late, but the word tonight is Gina. When you give it to the chauffeur, be sure no sentinel overhears you." With that he was up the wide steps, the glass doors had closed on him, and I stood there in the pitch black night, suddenly unable to believe that I was I, or Chalons, or that a young man who in Paris drops in to dine with me, and talk over new books and plays, had been whispering a password in my ear, to carry me unchallenged to a house a few streets away. The sense of unreality produced by that one word was so overwhelming that for a blissful moment the whole fabric of what I had been experiencing, the whole huge and oppressive and inescapable fact of the war, slipped away like a torn cobweb, and I seemed to see behind it the reassuring face of things as they used to be. The next morning dispelled that vision. We woke to a noise of guns closer and more incessant than even the first night's cannonade at Verdun, and when we went out into the streets it seemed as if, overnight, a new army had sprung out of the ground. Waylaid at one corner after another by the long tide of troops streaming out through the town to the northern suburbs, we saw in turn all the various divisions of the unfolding frieze. First the infantry and artillery, the sappers and miners, the endless trains of guns and ammunition, then the long line of gray supply wagons, and finally the stretcher bearers following the Red Cross ambulances. All the story of a day's warfare was written in the spectacle of that endless silent flow to the front. and we were to read it again, a few days later, in the terse announcement of Enud activity about suits, and of the bloody strip of ground gained between Perth and Bossiger. In Lorraine and the Vosges, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.